Welcome to the Ortho Joke Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, actually, it's good afternoon, Mo, instead of the usual good morning, Mo.
But you know what? You know what, Mark? I still have a little bit of a cup, and I have a branded ceramic one too. So this is a fancy one. I'm at today, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm here with my. It's not a fruity alcoholic drink. It's just some apple cranberry thing. But anyway, it's a beautiful afternoon here in Minnesota. Great to see you as always. We have. I think this is the first one where you actually have taken over as the editor in chief, and I've been very pleased to hand over the complaint department, which is your role number one. So it's all you now, man. So
you know what, Mark? I have this thing called a little black book, and I'm just making notes. That's all I'm doing. I'm making notes,
Making notes and taking names. Well,
That's right.
We have a fantastic guest to chat with on Ortho Joe this afternoon. My long-term friend and colleague, Dr. Mike Chapman. We use the word icon in orthopedics, and Mike is definitely in that rather short list. Mike is the chairman emeritus at UC Davis, as a much beloved orthopedic trauma surgeon who started at UCSF and then came over to UC Davis to become chair, and has trained many, many influential orthopedic trauma surgeons like David Templeman and Jim Goulet, and we could go on and on and on. And Mike also has served the entire world of orthopedic surgery as chair of the trustees of JBJS. He was the trustee chair when they selected Jim Heckman, I believe, after Harry Cowell retired. So he's been with the journal for decades, and also AOA past president and OTA founding member. Mike did the really hard work of getting the articles of incorporation done in California, which was a very thankless task that he did, but has been responsible for the great success in large measure of the OTA. But we're not here to talk about Mike's academic pedigree. We're here to talk about his textbook. And Mike has written Chapman's Orthopedics, I think in the fourth edition. And most recently, we signed a collaborative agreement between Mike's book and JBJS. Which we're grateful for. And Mike, let's just start out with sort of a generic question. Why is it that you decided to write this book way back decades ago?
Well, it's a little bit of an interesting story. This was back in the mid-1980s. And I was approached at the time by Saunders to do a competitive text to Rockwood and Green. And for various reasons, I decided I didn't want to do that. And so the end result of which they went ahead with Bruce Browner and Jesse Jupiter and you, Mark, and Dave Green, and produced your fantastic book on skeletal trauma. And then shortly after that, Lewis Reines, who at the time was president of Lippincott, approached me to do a competitive book, The Campbell's Operative Orthopedics, which at the time I think was published by Mosby. And I said, holy mackerel, you mean you want me to take on a text that's been published since 1939 and is the worldwide icon for orthopedics? But interestingly enough, at the time, I wasn't really that happy with Campbell's. And the main thing is that, and this is my impressions, that at the time, Campbell's was pretty slow to move forward with the advances in fracture fixation and trauma. And it may have had to do something with the philosophy of the book. And I know that maybe we don't have the time to get into the depths of what drove the way that they produced it. But I thought the main difference I noticed was that they had an in-house editorial board at the Campbell Clinic through the foundation that basically kind of pre-produced the book. And the authors were, of course, limited to the clinic. And they tended to base what they wrote on procedures that had been more or less published. And there wasn't a lot of room for surgeon opinion. Now, that's my personal opinion of what Campbell's was like at the time. superb book, but it had these limitations, I thought. So I thought that we could compete with this by doing a few things. First of all, I wanted to have a worldwide viewpoint from the very best surgeons in the world that were doing a given procedure. And I wanted them to tell us not only what was, you know, what the literature said about it, but wanted to give them the freedom to tell us what worked best in their hands and what were their tips and tricks. And that was a very different philosophical approach from Campbell's. And then, of course, we had two other things. We wanted the book to be very useful for the incoming resident. So every major subspecialty section would open with a group of basic chapters for the resident from year one up through five or six or fellows. And then we wanted to write at a subspecialty level. So we wanted every chapter to be written by the best person we could find for that particular procedure or entity. So that was the philosophy that we had when we went into publishing the book. And of course, our first publisher was Lippincott, and our first edition was published in 1988.
Right. And you've done now four editions, Mike, four updates?
Yes, we have four editions. The last one being the most recent one, which was published in 2019.
Okay. I'm going to ask just one more, and then you're going to get the difficult stuff from Mo. But so in your very educated opinion, how has the usefulness of textbooks evolved over those four editions?
Wow. Well, the question is, are textbooks just hovering on the edge of the grave or are they in the grave?
Another way to put it.
Well, as you know, with the availability of information now online, the question is, what role can a textbook play today? And I think there are probably a couple of roles. One is, it gives the possibility of organizing information in a comprehensive manner that makes acquisition and searching a lot easier. And the other is, there's the potential for a textbook to be dynamic. This is a bit of an aside, but when I did my third edition with Lippincott, at the time, we did not anticipate doing another print edition. Our plan was to transition to a fully electronic edition. And what we had planned to do was to no longer have the typical sort of five-year interval for updating the book, that we would make it a dynamic book where the authors would be allowed to update their chapters anytime they wanted when they felt that an advance occurred. And then the job of the section editors would be to, you know, keep an eye on their chapters and on their authors. And if the author didn't take the initiative, then to request that they update. So the book would become dynamic and be updated on a constant ongoing basis, which would hopefully make it, you know, one of the easiest, best, up-to-date, comprehensive references that one could have within the field. And I also should mention quickly, in the fourth edition, we added the word comprehensive into the title of the text. And the reason we did that was I wanted to add two key sections. You may or may not know that I did a year of PM&R residency as a part of my orthopedic training. And so my heart is close to the field of PM&R. So as you know, we have a 27 or 26 chapter section on PM&R in the book, because I wanted that the skills of that subspecialty to be incorporated into us. And then we also anticipated having a big section at the beginning that would be a correlative section on basic science. And unfortunately, my section editor for that didn't work out. So we did not put it in the book, which is probably a good thing, because it's a monster as it is right now, and it just would have made it unmanageable. So let's see. Did I answer your question?
No, you did. You absolutely did. Mo, what do you got for Dr. Chapman?
Well, listen, I mean, like, it's somewhat surreal, right? When you, when I'm here listening to sort of the journey you've had and your accolades, Dr. Chapman. And I'll tell you, like, from my perspective, you know, there are so many medical students right now who will see the accolades, they'll see the book, they'll see all of them, I mean, amazing successes. And they're going to go back and say, you know, was he once a medical student like me? Like, did he ever have, was he ever confused about what he wanted to do? How did he, like, how did this all work out for him? What do you say to that person who's thinking, I can never be a Mike Chapman, I'll never be able to do that? Were you as sure in medical school that this was the pathway, or was there ever a period of confusion, or was it good luck, open doors? How did it happen for you?
Well, I'll tell you a quick anecdote. My closest study buddy was Tom Chan, a Chinese immigrant who sat in front of me because they always sat us alphabetically in class. So it was Chan Chapman. Hmm. And he and I aspired to be physicians, but neither one of us in high school felt that we had the stuff to do it. So we went to a local community college and said, well, we both want to get into the patient business. We haven't got the stuff for medical school, so let's become dentists. So we applied for dental school at UCSF out of, you can believe this, out of community college. And we were both accepted.
Okay.
And then Tom and I both graduated number one and number two in our class at this community college. And that summer before we were to start dental school, Tom came to me and said, you know, Mike, the last thing I want to do is spend my whole life in the mouth. And I think that you and I proved that maybe we have the stuff to handle medical school. So I'm dropping out. And I said, you're doing what? So we both dropped out, went to UC Davis for our third year, and both got accepted to medical school out of our third year. So then the question is, how did I pick orthopedic surgery? Well, I'm an avid skier, and I could not afford to ski. So the way I paid was as soon as I was eligible, I became a member of the National Ski Patrol as a volunteer ski patrolman. So I spent my late high school years and my early college years caring for busted up skiers and transporting them off the ski hills. And of course, that's all musculoskeletal stuff.
Yeah.
And as all of us, you know, everything in medicine was attractive as I went through medical school. So I took a look at this and took a look at that. But my beeline was for orthopedic surgery right from the beginning.
And then you never look back, clearly. But now, okay, so I'm gonna bring you now to where you are now. And when you look back, you know, you've had, and I'll say it again, you know, anyone looking at your resume or calling or looking at anything you've done online would say, oh, this is just success after success after success. But we don't, and I know you know this, you don't really learn in life from your successes. You pretty well learn from all the setbacks and the, you know, I would call say the failures. Yet I have a sense right now that there's a generation of people who just don't want to risk failing. And I wonder if you could share any sort of insight on this issue of how important maybe setbacks or, you know, things that just didn't work out the way you thought they would actually shaped your academic career or your life.
Well, I think I wrote a little piece for the JBJS that talks about serendipity. And I would say that I've led a serendipitous life in that the pathway forward is never straight. And there's always going to be setbacks and there's always going to be unexpected events that can lead to unexpected opportunities. And let me tell you the story about how I became a traumatologist. Just before I was in the military during the Vietnam War in Europe for 3 years. And on my way there, I did a mini fellowship in total joint arthroplasty in England. This was in 1967. And I was based at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in London, but I spent time with Churnley and with McKeon Farr up in Norwich and at Stanmore. And at the time, a total joint had not, even though Churnley began doing them in 1958, I think it was, a total joint still had not been done in the U.S. So when I returned to San Francisco to my first job at UCSF, my plans were to become a total joint surgeon. But that was when the FDA first released the PMMA for use in patients. And the only way you could do a total joint when I came back in 1970 was that you had to have a research number. And so I got back and those numbers had all been issued. And I could not do a total joint because I didn't have that research number. And that opportunity was precluded for 2 years. And the first job I took was at San Francisco General Hospital as the assistant chief there, which was one of the premier early level one trauma centers in the United States. And my training was very, very heavy in trauma anyway. So I couldn't do total joints. So what do? When you're in a trauma hospital, you become a traumatologist. And so it wasn't as if I purposely picked it. It was a serendipitous experience. And I'll tell you, a better thing couldn't have happened to me in my entire life. I think I would have been absolutely, totally bored as a total joint surgeon. There's nothing better than doing trauma. And anyway, so my advice to the current generation coming up behind me is your life will be predictable. It'll be serendipitous, but take advantage of those serendipitous experiences because there's always an opportunity around the corner.
Well, it's funny. You know what? I'll remind you both of the Vancouver OTA meeting in Vancouver, Canada, maybe 1996 or so, something like that. Mm-hmm. I was a resident. And we were just about to try to pitch the idea of the sprint trial, which was going to, either die on that day or it was going to move forward. And I remember as a resident, I'd called you, Mark, and I'd gotten you, Mike, to show up. And people were asking me, who's coming? And I said, oh, we have a Dr. Chapman. They said, you got Dr. Chapman to come? And I go, yeah, he's coming. He goes, and I said, oh, yeah, Mark Swinkowski. You got Mark Swinkowski come? So then Paul Turnetta says, okay, I'll be there. and Agnew was there, and I'll never forget the debate. And that trial, I thought was dead in the water after that meeting. I thought, okay, because everyone's kind of there's two proponents, as you remember, right? Paul Turnetta very strongly for an unreamed nail, and there was the Sam Agnew saying, "Take it easy, Paul. We got the reamed nail side." Anyways, I was with Professor Gordon Guide, who's an epidemiologist and had, had done a lot. And he said to me, he goes, okay, well, it sounds like there's just so much argument. I thought we'd do something special. It's not going to work out. And then I remember stopping and everyone saying, no, Gord, we're interested. This is just how we communicate. We're all in. And I will never forget that moment because that was, as you would say, Mike, the serendipitous moment that I, that door opened. And, and I guess in some ways we never look back, but I'll always be grateful to you and Mark for attending that meeting. So anyways, a big thank you for that.
That's great, Mo. Yeah, Les, I got a phone call from Mike, I want to say two academies ago. I was in the booth, as I'm inclined to be, and Mike called and said, we're having a lot of trouble with the publisher of the fourth edition of my book and was wondering if there would be any way that JBJS would be interested in some sort of collaboration. And I immediately found the idea attractive and I got in touch with Jason Miller, who was the chief operating officer at the time and now the CEO as of January 1st. And we have worked out this agreement with Mike and the book. And given what Mike said earlier about books being in the grave or on the way to the grave, one might ask, well, how is it that the journal finds this valuable? Well, one of the things is that there's well over 1,000 really, really well done illustrations, which are going to be useful for the library in clinical classroom, which is our adaptive learning platform.
Mark, excuse me for interrupting. There's 4,400 line drawings in it, 14,000 illustrations.
That's exactly what I said, 14,000 illustrations. Thank you for repeating that, Mike. I appreciate that very much. So it is going to be useful in the library of materials for clinical classroom and the text there as well for individuals who want to have a more in-depth learning on an individual knowledge probe, which is what we call it in adaptive learning. So it's going to be useful there. It's going to be useful on what we call the hub internally, which is the jbjs.org, which is way more than just a online journal for anybody who hasn't visited jbjs.org. There's all kinds of opportunities to use video content and other curated content to learn with or give presentations. There's a lot there. So there's going to be a taking apart of the book for these various applications, but also the book will be kept together. And Mike, you mentioned earlier in the conversation about updating. What are the plans to update? What do you see in the future for that?
Well, I think, you know, to a great extent, obviously, that's up to you guys. And of course, we're at the point now where the this edition was published in 2019. So we're approaching 5 years out on it.
Yeah.
And everything that's there was written, of course, between, 2016 and 2019, if you look at a three-year process for producing a book of this size. So everything needs to be updated. As far as leadership is concerned, the section editors currently are almost all from the Department of Orthopedic Surgery here at UC Davis, with the exception of three who were at UC Davis but have now left and gone to other institutions who have expressed interest in continuing. And as you know, in many textbooks like this, you invite a senior author to write, but it's often done by his fellow or his resident. So I think the first step is to gather a section editor group and have them reach out to all the authors. And there's going to probably have to be a fair amount of new author acquisition. And then I don't know if there's going to be a need to change or add content from the standpoint of table of contents, but then just simply ask people to update. And I would hope that the model would be this idea of continuous updating to keep it as current as possible. And that initial organization is going to be a big job, by the way, because over that period of time, of course, a lot of authors have changed positions. And so there's going to be a lot of new recruiting and arm bending done.
Well, I've had several conversations with Laura Randall, your successor, a department head, and he tells me that the faculty are all in. So those will be future discussions, but we really see the book as a major asset at the journal and are grateful for the fact that you offered it to us, Mike. And I want to just conclude by thanking you for everything you've done for orthopedic surgery. And for me, personally and professionally, it's been a great 45 plus year relationship with you and Betty. For your time, we don't have an example, neither Mo or I have an example of the absolutely priceless Ortho Joe travel mug, but look for that in the mail and guard it with your life, because there's no way to get one apart from being a guest on Ortho Joe. So Mike, thanks. You won't believe it when you see it. So thanks. thanks for your time. And Mo, just one last thing. I hope you are noticing that since you assumed the EIC position, I now am no longer wearing a tie. For Ortho Joe, I got some swag on, but
listen, I feel all of our necks are just breathing and enjoying the comfort of no tie. So I'm just going to keep it going.
That's great.
Freedom of free choice.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. Thanks, Mo. Always great to chat, and have a great rest of your day.
Absolutely. Thank you. Pleasure.
Bye.
Bye. Take care.